Hello and welcome to the LSTM podcast series, where we meet some of the most curious minds in science. Today, we meet with Dr. Mark Payne, who will be discussing his research into quantifying insecticide residues for vector control programs and how this novel technology may help reduce increasingly widespread insecticide resistance. Then we hear from Professor Imelda Bates, who talks about her research into anemia and capacity building in resource-poor settings. First up, we hear from Chris Spencer and Dr. Mark Payne.
Today I'm speaking to Dr. Mark Payne, who works here at LSTM as a reader in the vector group. Mark is head of the enzyme characterization group, and today we're going to talk about the insecticide quantification kits. Hi, Mark.
Hi.
Firstly, I thought it'd be good if you could just briefly explain what an IQK is.
An IQK is an insecticide quantification kit, and these are very simple assays which are designed to measure insecticides that are being sprayed on walls for malaria and other disease control programs, and also to try and measure the insecticides that are being used on bed nets, which are being distributed across Africa as we speak.
So how exactly were they developed and how do they work?
The initial development happened a few years ago. Janet Hemingway and John Vontas started developing tests to measure pyrethroids, and then in 2006, at the start of the IVCC program, the development of pyrethroid quantification kits was one of the programs that was first sort of started then. And so through that, a test was developed by Harper Cash Kaur at the London School to monitor pyrethroids or cyanopyrethroids. And from there, we then developed kits to measure DDT and more recently organophosphates and carbamates. So it's been a sort of a process that started off with the development of tests to monitor pyrethroids in bed nets, and has now morphed over the years into a whole range of tests that can monitor the insecticides that are used for spraying as well. And along the way, a lot of people actually at the school have been involved in these projects, and I should probably mention a few of them. Hanafi Ismail had a major role in developing the current DDT test. We've had Andy Stevens, who actually now works up in Mark Taylor's group, did a lot of work in the early days on the tests. As did Andy Dowd, who's now is working over in Liverpool. Evangelier is another person who we know has come over here a lot and did a lot of work on it. And all these people actually did a lot of work in the early development of these tests and as they're coming through now.
So what impact do they have on vector control?
Well, that's an interesting question, and one which we can't answer yet. For the simple reason that up until now, we've never had any tests that have been able to be used to measure insecticides on walls or in bed nets. And so, really, this is a question we're hoping to answer over the next couple of years, that now that we have these tests available, we can now start to really understand what impact these spray programs are really having. And just to give you an indication that we think it will have a big impact is that where we've used these tests in our field trials, we've been able to show that quite often that the levels of spraying are not what they should be. And again, also we've been testing various bed nets, and we have come across counterfeit bed nets which are being sold as containing insecticides, but haven't got them at all. So we are fairly confident with these tests now on board that we're going to make a major, it could have a major impact really on how these things are used.
So where are these kits used, or where will they be used?
Well, so far these kits have been used in Vanuatu, where we did a small trial with the control program out there, and what they've been doing is spraying a cyanopyrethroid, lambda cyhalothrin, and we were able to follow them and measure the amounts of insecticide that was going onto the walls. And what we found actually was that they were doing a very good job, that about 80% of the houses that they were spraying at that time were were being sprayed with the right levels. And actually, if you look at Vanuatu, the island actually we used was a Tanner Island, and actually you'd be hard pressed there to try and find the vector, because at the same time actually I went out with John Morgan, and it was one of those sort of quite nice places to do a field trial. And John was while he was out there was doing his entomology business and trying to find and trying to get some larvae and try and find the vector, which was Anopheles ferruti, I think is ferruti. I'll have to come back to that. And really, he was unable to find any. So we think that that, again, sort of demonstrated, certainly in that area, that they're doing a good job. And it's being seen by the fact that we've got very low levels of the vector out there. It's also been used in field trials in various locations in Africa. Bioko Island is one of them, and we're in the stage now where these kits are starting to be commercialized. So they're not yet on the market, and we're expecting them to be on the market sometime within the next few months. And it's at that point then that we'll get a better idea of the take up and where they're being used. But another place where we are developing these tests, and we're starting to use them now, is over in India, where these tests were developed initially for the malaria control programs. But in Bihar State in India, they've got a big problem with a visceral leishmaniasis, which is transmitted by sandflies. And so there they're using DDT to control for their control operations. And so we've developed a DDT detection kit, which we're currently putting through field trials at the moment. So we think India is going to be a big market, actually, for some of these DDT kits that we're developing. And we should see these being rolled out in the next couple of years. And again, that's all coming under the sort of auspices of a Wellcome Trust program, which we've got running out there. So I think those are the sort of areas, as we will see within the next few years, once these things get on the market, we will then start to see where they're being used and the impact that they're making.
So what's next? What's your next goal with the IQK?
Technically, the next goal is organophosphates. We're developing an organophosphate kit, and I should say Hanafi is developing this kit at the moment. And that's important because with the resistance issues, there is a resistance issue with the use of pyrethroids. Almost everything, almost all the mosquitoes in Africa, you could say now, are resistant to pyrethroids. So for the IRS programs, they basically can't use pyrethroids anymore. They've been using carbamates, but carbamates are causing resistance issues now. And so really the last throw of the dice is organophosphates. So starting this year, you're starting to see campaigns using organophosphate insecticides. And so what we're trying to do is to develop, we're very close to developing a test that can be used to monitor the amount of organophosphates that they're using on walls. Now, the importance of getting that out quickly is that if the sooner we can start to monitor the correct use, we can make sure that the right amounts are being used, and we can try and minimize the issues of resistance, which will obviously come in if the spraying is not being done properly. So we've got a very good opportunity here if we can move fast enough to get a kit out there at the start of spray programs where we're starting to use these insecticides for the first time. And then finally, I think the single most important thing that we want to do, our sort of real ultimate goal, is to get these kits integrated as standard operating procedures into vector control operations. Because up until now, as I said, nobody has really been able to tell if the right amounts of insecticides are getting out there. Now that we have the tools available, we need to convince people that these tests should be used as a natural part of their control programs, so that we can make absolutely sure that the right amount of insecticide is being sprayed in the right places at the right time to do the job.
That all sounds brilliant. Thanks very much for your time this morning, Mark.
Thank you.
Thank you to both Chris and Mark for the interview. Now we move on to Kayla Barnes, who is talking with Professor Imelda Bates.
Today I'm speaking with Professor Imelda Bates, a clinical hematologist and the head of the International Public Health Department at LSTM. Imelda's research focuses on anemia and blood transfusion, as well as capacity building in lower and middle income countries. Professor Bates, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
A large focus of your work has been on public health aspects of anemia and blood transfusion in lower and middle income countries. These are health aspects we take for granted here in the UK. Can you shed some light on the current capacity of some of the countries you work in to deal with these health issues?
Certainly. Well, anemia is one of the highest global burden causes of disability. And particularly in lower and middle income countries, it affects children and pregnant women. And in many countries, up to 50% of those groups of people can be affected by anemia. And it's often a hidden problem, because even small amounts of anemia can cause reduction in productivity for the working population, and it can cause problems with child development and intellectual development. And so there's a great hidden burden of loss because of chronic high prevalence of anemia. So one of the other problems is that it's almost taken for granted. It's so common that there's not very much public health attention on anemia. And in fact, it's one of the tests that is most difficult to perform well in hospitals, even though it's assumed that it's done very well. It's in fact not. And we've done quite a lot of research to show that measuring anemia is difficult. And partly, anemia is also difficult to control because it's very multifactorial. There are many reasons why people are anemic. They often interact. So, for instance, in one child, they might have sickle cell plus anemia plus some nutritional deficiencies, and unless you fix all of those problems, their anemia really isn't going to resolve.
So you also focus on blood transfusions, which is something that here in the UK we know that we can get if we go into a hospital after a traumatic injury or other health issues. Mm-hmm. But in a lot of lower and middle income countries, there's a massive lack of blood. How do you motivate blood donors in communities where there may be misconceptions and a lack of exposure to blood donation?
Yes, certainly blood transfusion is a major issue. And I think we do take it for granted in wealthy countries that if we go to a hospital, there's going to be blood available. I think one of the most life-changing experiences I had was as a junior doctor working in West Africa and seeing pregnant women come into the hospital bleeding and then finding that the blood bank fridge is empty and there's no blood, and they're dying just because there's no blood in the blood bank. And so we have actually done some research that has shown that about 26% of pregnant women who are bleeding severely, who get into hospital, actually die because there isn't any blood available. And so that's been a big drive for our current project, which I'll speak a bit more about in a minute, to try and improve ways of getting more blood in the bank. And obviously there are two main ways of trying to improve the situation. One is to not waste blood, so there's a big responsibility for clinicians to make sure that they try everything else first and that they only use blood when it's absolutely essential. Mm-hmm. But also to try and get more donors to donate, and particularly not just getting new donors in, but retaining people who've already donated. And I think there's a big lack of push, really, to try and keep people retained. And actually, we know that those are the most safe donors in terms of infection risk. So we have several projects where we're looking at trying to increase donor motivation and retention.
That's a very interesting problem that I'm sure most of the world is facing and we take for granted. Additionally, your work focuses on capacity development. You recently published an article about strengthening laboratory systems, as well as many articles about just strengthening capacity in general. Can you explain how you've approached capacity building and the most important aspects of this moving forward?
Well, probably the best way to explain it is to give you a practical example around issues of anemia and blood transfusion. So one of the problems that we identified in collaboration with a lot of African transfusion directors and people that use blood a lot, like anaesthetists, obstetricians, paediatricians, was that there's virtually no research capacity in transfusion in Africa. And that actually means that many of the policies that have been developed in the West actually can't be adapted for Africa. They may not be appropriate, but there isn't enough research and people doing research in Africa to be able to adapt the policies to make them appropriate for that setting. And so, in addition to getting a research agenda together with this group of people, we also managed to put together a program to try and build capacity in the transfusion services in Africa to get them to be able to generate their own research, which would help improve their own systems. So we've got a project with the African Society for Blood Transfusion and transfusion services in Ghana and Zimbabwe, and with some partners from the European Union, so from Denmark and from the Netherlands. And what we're doing is working with people in the transfusion services in Africa to help them develop research skills. So we're essentially supporting them to do their own project in the workplace. It's a part-time course so they can tackle a problem that's of importance to their transfusion service. And the benefit of that is that they don't leave work, so they're never out of the workplace, which is a problem that's been encountered in the past with taking people away to Europe and elsewhere to train. So they stay at work and they're doing a project that's of direct relevance to them and the transfusion service directors. So the course is actually run by local tutors. So again, we're not sending people out from here, they're doing it all themselves. But we in Liverpool are putting the quality assurance mechanisms in place so that we know that the training that people get is up to international standard. And what that's really done is it's generated a lot of new research, obviously, which is very valuable for the local service. So the transfusion service directors are able to pick up that research immediately. It's being done in their units. They were involved in designing it. They've supported the students to do the work. And so it's been very helpful for example, the things we were talking about around donor motivation. Mm-hmm. Because we know that the messages that motivate donors in Liverpool, for example, are not the same messages that are going to motivate donors in Zimbabwe or in Ghana and elsewhere. There are a lot of misconceptions there about blood transfusion. So, for example, there are stories going around that men will become impotent if they donate blood, or that by donating blood you might catch infections. And so these are messages that need to be incorporated into the training and the adverts for trying to recruit donors. And they're not the sort of things we would think about including here to motivate mm-hmm. donors. So mm-hmm. that's just one example of some of the research that's been done in the transfusion centres as part of the programme that's been picked up. It's already been included in the new donor motivation programmes.
So this programme is in its final year. It's called the TREC programme. What does TREC stand for?
It's Transfusion Research Capacity. It's very it's not a direct abbreviation.
Okay, but gives us the... It's a good title.
It's a flavour. Yes, it's catchy. Yeah,
it's
people
catchy.
Don't forget it.
No. So the TREC programme is in its final year, and you recently had a meeting in Zimbabwe with all the countries involved. What are some of the successes that you heard about that are coming out of this programme?
Well, there are some easily measurable successes. So, for example, we've got 4 PhD students. Mm-hmm. We've had over 40 of these students doing this research skills course, a diploma course. And those have generated several papers that have already been published, several others in draft, and many conference presentations, including some by people who have never stood up and given a presentation or done research before. And I were extremely nervous, I have to say, at the recent meeting in Zimbabwe, but did a great job. So that's sort of easily measurable success. But the less easily measurable, but I think in the long run extremely important success, is the fact that the people in the blood transfusion services are now saying that they've gotten a sort of established research culture, which we never had there before. It's reinvigorated their thirst for knowledge, their interested to ask questions and to solve problems for themselves. So I think in the long run, overall, we hope what the programme has done, and it's very, very short time, but we hope that it has been able to help people to take the lead on generating some new locally relevant evidence for the transfusion services in these countries and elsewhere.
So much more work to come.
Plenty.
Yes. Thank you, Imelda. If you would like more information about the TREC project or anything else Professor Bates is involved in, you can visit the LSTM Capacity Research Unit website. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you to both Kayla and Imelda for the interview. For further information on either of this month's speakers, please look up their staff profiles on the LSTM website. Meanwhile, I hope you've enjoyed listening and will join us again for the November podcast, brought to you by the Liverpool School of Tropical Medicine.